You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, welcome to the final long-form podcast of 2018.
Happy holidays.
Hey, you guys.
It all comes to another close. What year is this?
How long have we been doing this?
Who did we get for this last show of the year?
The guest this week is Allison P. Davis. She writes for New York Magazine and GQ. She's written for The Ringer, all kinds of places. She does those good celebrity profiles.
She did that Lena Dunham profile recently.
Yeah, she wrote about Lena Dunham. She wrote about Cardi B. The articles are fun to read.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
We have a category on our best of list, which is out now. People should go look at our best of 2018 picks. But we did a category historically called Highly Entertaining.
Yes.
Allison P. Davis, highly entertaining writer.
Highly entertaining.
Hitting the highly entertaining list.
Yes.
Yes. We're brought to you, as always, by MailChimp. They've been with us since year one, another holiday season with MailChimp. Start a MailChimp newsletter. It supports the show.
And now here's Max with Allison Davis.
Hi, Allison.
Oh, hey, Max.
Welcome to the show. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I appreciate it. I spent some time in the last couple of days looking into your past.
Oh, God, okay.
And your background. And the answer is I failed.
Really?
There's not a lot about, who you are and where you grew up on the internet.
Oh, that's so exciting. I've always wanted to be sort of an enigma, so I like this.
Well, we're going to tear it all down now.
Great.
This is going to be the thing that future generations will come back to, and all of your secrets will have been spilled. Where did you grow up? How did you start doing this? Who are you?
Who am I? Well, the thing is, I will say that, Allison Davis is a really common name.
Yeah.
So that's just impossible to find us. There's four that go to my bookstore and I get different Allison Davis's mail in Brooklyn. It's pretty easy not to find me.
There are also Allison Davis magazine writers.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that why you're Allison P?
Exactly. Yeah. And I've actually met one of my doppelgangers, shout out to other Allison Davis who now lives in LA. And we're both black women who write, who moved from Oakland to Fort Greene within a month of each other. And it was okay, this is getting weird. She's a little bit older and is now writing for TV. So I guess that's my next step.
Yeah.
So
oh, that's nice to have someone who's just a little down the whole your life span.
Yeah. I can just follow her. I'm from Baltimore originally, the suburbs of Baltimore, because I know I'll get blasted for that. I'm from Cockeysville, which is a suburb of Baltimore.
Cockeysville?
Yes, yeah. And it's spelled exactly like you think it is.
Okay.
And I guess I started working at magazines when I was in college. I went to Barnard and I always sort of knew I wanted to write. And because of all the rom-coms I watched, I was well, obviously I have to be in magazines and obviously I have to start working in fashion. So I interned as much as I could as a student while also working in the student bookstore to supplement not having not getting paid at these internships. So I interned at Jane and Teen Vogue and like Brides. And when I went home for the summer, I would do like the local papers in Baltimore Magazine, which is
like the city paper.
I was never cool enough for city paper. I went like glossy, like tourist mag, not like cool. If I could do it again, I would have gone cool alt mag. It would have changed my life, I think.
How?
I probably would have gone to cooler stuff. And like everything for the glossy Baltimore Magazine was very like, what would your mom want to do on a Sunday? And so like that
top
was
five
my
yachts.
Life. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like where to get the best crab cakes without like going too far into the inner city. And like, so I feel like if I'd done something like city paper, it would have made me cooler. I would have gone to like grimier shows and like been a little, you know, more hipster edgy.
When are we talking about? What year is this?
Oh, this would be from like 2004 to 2008. That's when I went to college. And so my first like big internship, I guess, was at Teen Vogue in 2007, 2008 with this woman, Lee Bells, who is now, I think, at Vogue. Sorry if that's wrong, Lee. She's at Vogue. And she was the first person to be like, oh, you're kind of good at this. And like, I'm not just going to make you like carry racks of clothes around. Like, you can write for the blog.
How did you like, how'd you stand out as an intern? How do you do that?
Honestly, I think one person gave me some insight into this once is that I'm just like, I seem really nice. And like, don't let people, oh, so what did she say? She was like, oh, being nice goes a long way. So like, just, you're just really nice. So I'm going to keep giving you chances. And I was like, okay, I think this is at Jane. And I was like, okay, I like don't really think I'm that nice. What I think you're saying is that I'm sort of a pushover, but I'll take it if like you're going to pay attention to me. So in every internship, I just like showed up with the biggest smile on my face, no matter what crap I had to do, which is like not a good lesson. Nobody should do those things. Like, don't get dry cleaning with a smile on your face, but I did it. And Lee's also a very, very nice person and a very patient person. So I think we just sort of were kindred. So I started writing for her and she actually gave me my first magazine article, which was a couple years later when I was in grad school. She asked me to find like a teen mom to talk to. Uh-huh. So during the era of like MTV's Teen Mom. And so that was my first thing I did, was like profiling a little like a teen mom in California.
Did the stakes feel high?
Oh, really high. And to this day, like, I think Lee was so kind, but I like really botched that one. Like, I turned in some messy ass copy.
She was like 27 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, so messy ass copy. And,
yeah, the story was...
Story's not good.
How so? What was not good?
I don't know. Like, it was a teen mom from MTV. Her name was Marcy Bookout. I think she's the most popular teen mom. And like, I didn't really know what questions to ask her. So I was like, what's it like being a mom? And she's like, something more specific, please. Like, and so, I mean, I just learned a lot in terms of like what an angle was. I don't know. I actually didn't learn that much. I'm sorry, Lee, but she was really patient with me and made the story very good for what it was. But it was like 600 words. And I was so disappointed that I couldn't even figure out how to do that.
So like, all right, we're talking about like late aughts. Basically.
Yeah. So I went to Berkeley J School right after college because I graduated in the recession and like.
Yeah, you graduated in 08.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no jobs. So I decided to go to grad school and then like instead just like incur a lot of debt. So I went to Berkeley because I'd always wanted to live in California and I studied magazine journalism and documentary filmmaking because I could. Berkeley's a 2-year program and you can do what you want. So like it was great to sort of sit in classrooms and read lots of profiles and lots of long form journalism and like get someone who's much smarter than me like analyze it. And I feel like I learned a lot that way. And then also Lee would throw me freelance work and I started writing little bar reviews for the Alt Weekly in Oakland, East Bay Express, and the paper in San Francisco. So like 200 word bar reviews so I could go drink for free.
Yeah.
And then that's sort of how I started doing more voicey stuff and figuring it out.
How did it feel to be in J school in 2009 and 2010? Was like, did not seem like boom times for magazines and you were like paying to learn how to work at a magazine.
Right. I never thought, I mean, I guess I'm a little like, I was a little Pollyanna. Like I was just out of college. So I was like, everything's going to be fine. But it was interesting because Berkeley was pretty smart in how it adapted. So like, yes, you could do your long form journalism class, but everybody was required to start like a blog. And there was a lot of thinking about digital media and like not being afraid of that.
Yeah.
So that was helpful. But it was a was it worth the investment?
That's my question.
No. I mean, no, because when I got out of J school, I still like immediately started as an assistant at a fashion magazine. So it was just like I delayed the inevitable by 2 years.
You think you could have gotten that gig before J school?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, it was really fun to be able to sit with people who were at like the top of their game and like have them explain to you like what a nut graph is and like how to transition and all that stuff. But I actually have learned a lot more of that on the job than I did in a classroom.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm sorry, Berkeley. The worst ad ever.
You just got like taken off every alumni list.
They're never going to let me do those alumni interviews.
Listen,
again.
They taught you to speak truth to power.
It's
you
true.
Know?
Yeah. Don't go to J school.
Don't go to J school. Okay, so then you get out of there and you landed like an assistant editor job.
Yeah, I was an assistant editor I was an editorial assistant at Elle.
What is that job? What do you do in that job?
I was in the features department and I came in from J school thinking I was gonna be writing features. So I was like pitching like crazy and everyone's sort of like, oh, could you like book travel for this writer? Or like,
you seem nice.
You seem so nice. Could you get the mail and like make sure it's on my desk at 11 a.m.? And so I did a lot of scut work. And the thing is, I'm not like I was, what, 23? No, 24. And I was a mess. Like, I barely paid my own bills on time. So, like, I'm so sorry to all of the writers who sent their contracts in, signed, expecting pay. And I was like, what do I do with this?
I will get to this when I damn well want to.
Yeah. I have a lot of other stuff to do. So it became very apparent to my bosses that I was, like, not a good assistant. So my time at Elle was a little tough. But, like, a lot of what I did was research for other writers who were doing features or, like, transcribing. And so, like, in every scut pile, there's like some lessons to learn. And I learned a lot from listening to other people interview and like doing their research, and also pitching in editorial meetings was always really fun. So,
okay. So what happens next? Where after everyone's like, you're not a good assistant, then what happens?
So I stayed at, I have a tendency of staying in things too long that aren't good for me. So I stayed at Elle for 2.5 years. And
that sounds like you want to talk about some relationships.
Don't ask about my exes. So 2.5 years. And I just remember, God, this is like, I'm probably saying way too much, but I just remember one editor was sort of like, took me aside and was like, I feel like you're always asking people like what you can do better and like how you can be a better writer and how you can get ahead. But like, I just want you to know that like, that's not going to happen for you here. So if I were you, I would find a new job. And I was like, oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. So then I just sat down at my work computer one day and I cold emailed a bunch of people, and one of them was Stella Bugby. And I was like, I need a new job. I'm looking for a job. Do you have a job? This is what I can do. And she asked me to come in for an interview. And then that's how I ended up at The Cut.
How many emails did you send?
I sent like 15 cold emails to any place I could think of, mostly online, like Gawker, Jezebel, just everywhere. And it was weird because I was coming from print and like, as an assistant, you don't have any bylines, and like trying to go work at Gawker or like Jezebel or even The Cut, where it was all about voice and a presence on the internet and like a Twitter account, and I didn't have any of those things. I'm surprised that like anybody wrote me back. Stella was the only one that wrote me back. So I'm surprised Stella wrote me back.
Do you remember what the gist of that email was?
It was like, I work in fashion, and like I just recently wrote a feature about my hair, and I love The Cut. And I want to be a cut woman. Can I come in and just talk to you? And lucky for me, their fashion blogger was departing and they just needed somebody. And I guess like I seemed nice enough to like let into a building. So I came and I met with her. And I actually didn't know that much about fashion. So I had to like fudge it a lot. And I don't know, whatever. It worked, because then I got a job at The Cut. And that was kind of the start of most of the rest of my career.
When was that?
That was 2013. So I worked at Elle from 2011 to 2013. That was 2013.
Okay, so 2013, you're at The Cut.
Yeah.
You somehow talked your way into a fashion job, even though you didn't know very much about fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Stella. I think she knew that, like, it was pretty apparent immediately that I, like, did not have the depth of knowledge I needed. Then it was just kind of fun because it was like, we'll figure out, like, what you are good at. Like, mm-hmm. I think my first week we had a talk and she was like, you're voicey and you're funny, so like we'll just figure it out. And then I did a lot of fashion stuff, and I did a lot of like I remember I had to do Fashion Week, and she just like sent me backstage to do beauty reporting. And I was like, I don't know anything about beauty, so I guess I'm just going to write about not knowing about beauty. And nobody read the post, I don't think. Maybe someone did. But it was enough to sort of just like get me out of the sort of prison of like L thinking, which was like, you are part of a magazine and most you write is like a 200 word blurb with no name on it. And yeah, so I had a year where I was just trying to figure out what it meant to blog. And then I sort of switched to more like wider pop culture stuff and found like a niche doing first person stuff.
The first person stuff, like what's the first piece you can remember where it sort of like, it felt like you?
Okay, the first piece that really felt like me was we did this like Thanksgiving Eve sex roundup. Sorry, mom and dad. And it was like, tell your most like wild tales of like having sex on Thanksgiving Eve, that night when everyone comes home for Thanksgiving holiday from college. And I just like wrote about a thing that happened to me. You can go read it. I'm not going to say it because I'm going to start blushing or sweating or both. And I was like, oh, you can just like be yourself and be funny and talk about something that happened to you. And like people seemed to like it. So that was that. And it felt like me, mostly because it was about me.
Was it nerve wracking to have it go out on the internet?
No. And then that's how I knew that I was just naturally a narcissist. Like I liked that attention.
You're about it.
Yeah, I was into it.
Hey, we're going to take a little break because I have something to tell you. And the thing is that the program is supported this week by Aspen Ideas to Go. Aspen Ideas to Go is a weekly podcast. It's all about the big ideas that are going to open your mind. It features fascinating talks and conversations with the world's top thinkers and doers from the Aspen Institute. It also gives you front row access to the annual Aspen Ideas Festival. You, like me, probably not normally invited to the Aspen Ideas Festival, but now you can go or bring it to you with more than 400 thought leaders who go to Aspen every year to talk about everything from politics to economics, world affairs to arts, culture, science, the whole gamut. There's a huge variety on the show that's going to pique your curiosity. One week, you might catch Madeleine Albright talking about the world and how it works or no longer works. Next week, you might get a lively talk with Adam Grant about how you can make your work life more meaningful. Subscribe to Aspen Ideas to Go right now and get the best of Aspen Ideas every week. Just pull out your phone, search Aspen Ideas to Go on the podcast app that you are listening to this show on right now, or you can go to aspenideas.org/podcast. Feed your curiosity. Get smarter. Listen to Aspen Ideas to Go. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show. Let's get back to Allison. All right. So you're like putting these things out on the internet.
Yes.
Finding your voice a little bit.
Yes.
Writing about Thanksgiving Eve sex and hoping your parents don't read it.
Yeah. They never did. Again, sorry, mom and dad.
Well, hopefully they listen to this and they can go back and find it. It'll be in the show notes. Mom and dad, if you're listening, you can just go down and the link will be right there.
Lucky me.
And then how did you start making this move into features?
Oh, that was a real battle because like blogging is such a different brain. And I think when you're good at blogging, it's hard to convince anybody to let you try other things. But so while I was blogging, I would always try and do like what was considered features for sort of the web. Like I really was obsessed with these two girls in LA that like had their own like weed delivery service. So I like went to LA and like did a ride along with them. And so like this little by little, I would just like supplement blogging with like features sort of in my own time.
And was it almost like you had like a kind of like bank account with the cut where like as long as you were keeping your like blogging duties up to par, you could go like fuck around with other things?
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a lot of work. Never slept, which is fine. And I would always like every time like Stella and I would have my like annual review, I'd be like, okay, but now it's time for me to like give up blogging and just do feature writing. And she was like, keep blogging. Because like traffic, I work at a website, like traffic matters. And like not every feature was like definitely not going to get as many clicks as like a good dick joke, you know? So I did that for a while. And then I just came to a point where I really had much more of a clear idea that I wanted to be doing features and I wanted to try my hand at profiles. And I just like didn't have any idea how to do it. So I got asked to do a British Vogue profile of Gigi Hadid. And this is probably like 2014, 2015. And I I was like, yes, of course I'll do it. And so I tried to do it, and it was seriously so bad. And I'm embarrassed to say that 3 years ago I was publishing very bad profiles, but it was awful. I remember the editor wrote back and was like, I didn't ask you to write like a fangirl account of like meeting Gigi Hadid. Could you please like try again? And I was like, oh my God.
Really?
So, yeah, it was really embarrassing. And it was a cover story.
Oh man, what does that feel like when you get that email?
Why even try? Honestly, I was like, I should probably just like do something else. Or just like never do anything but blogging, because obviously like I'm good at that and I'm really bad at this thing. And that was a lot more work. So like, why try? But I'm also just like a little bit, I don't know if masochist is the right word, but like I do kind of feed off of negative energy. This is more about my psyche than I intended it to be. So instead of thinking like I'm never going to do this, I decided to find ways to get better. Yeah. And I like just started doubling down on pitching a lot more. And I landed a couple things in the magazine that David Marchese edited, and he taught me sort of a lot about like what a profile should look like. I like took a lot of writing classes in my own time to figure out like how to write a feature.
Really? Yeah. Where'd you take classes?
I actually took a long form writing class with Taffy.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. And that was sort of the moment where I was like, because I always looked up to her and like read her stuff and was like, I wanna do what Taffy does. Like I wanna write the Hillsong piece. Like I wanna write, you know, also Jessica Pressler. I was like, I want to write that, you know, score stripper Robin Hood piece. Like, how do I do that? And Taffy was teaching a class and I signed up, and like, it was a weekend in a conference room in a WeWork, and I was like, I learned so much, and I just sort of like exploded that thing that I needed to explode or whatever.
She's so good. It's so charming.
I know. Yeah. See, likable. Likeable. Like, nice. It goes a long way. And also I would like email people all the time at work, which is like so obnoxious, to be like, hey, I really like that story. Could you tell me exactly what you did? Just tell me how you thought of the idea, how you pitched it. And like, not everyone had the time to do that. But I was always making like a nuisance of myself, I think. And I was probably too old to do that. Like, it sounds like I was like 19, but I was like 27.
I think that's okay.
Okay.
I think that's all right.
Yeah. So then I just realized that at the cut at that moment, the blog stuff was my job, and I wanted to be writing longer and like wanted to have more time to figure that out. So I went to The Ringer, because they like didn't really have a blog, but they had like, you know, I had to like write like a piece a week, and then I could focus on like learning what I wanted features to look like for me.
And you were at The Ringer like at the start, right?
Yeah, I was one of the first hires on the culture desk, and I was under Amanda Dobbins, who's also like a really great editor, and like she just sort of let me try my hand at profiles and stuff. So that's sort of where I figured out that I liked doing profiles and was kind of okay at them.
What was it like? What was the difference between going from like these established kind of glossy magazines, even if you were working more for the digital side, to like a startup?
It's interesting. It didn't ever really feel that different, because The Cut for my time there was still so small. It still felt sort of like startup-y and like Wild Wild West, which is why it was so fun. We could try everything. And so even though it like worked within New York Mag, that environment always felt like I was free to take risks. And then at The Ringer, it was kind of the same thing. Like, Bill Simmons had such his own reputation, and like we were built on the back of Grantland, that it sort of felt like we still had a legacy attached to like this Wild Wild West. We can do what we want and try new things. There was a lot of pressure, though, I will say, to like not fuck it up and just to like make sure that the content was really good and that like it stood out. And I felt like I couldn't have lazy days the way I could at The Cut, you know.
No, I don't know what you mean by that.
Oh god. Okay, so like with the blog, like, yes, I'm turning out a lot, but like you're turning out so much that like you don't expect every song to be a hit, right? So like I could have 5 posts a day, and maybe 3 of them did really well, and 2 of them I was like, listen, I had to write something. And then at The Ringer, was like, I was writing less, and people were sort of like unsure of what it was. So I felt like everything had to be a lot more consistently like a hit. Mm-hmm. It was not, but like I felt like the pressure, like it had to be, I think.
Was there a piece from that early time that you feel like, part of what I'm interested in is just like how you find your like rhythm and voice with this. So like, yeah, if you're not doing the blogging as much, you're focusing on this feature writing, was there a piece there that was like, you felt like, well, this was good?
Yeah, I think there was a profile I did of, there were 3, but I'll go with just the one. there was this profile I did of Lainey Gossip. She's a gossip blogger. And it was sort of like the perfect, like, the topic was something that I was really invested in and, like, knew a lot about and cared a lot about, celebrity gossip and Lainey. And I was able to be, like, voicey and funny and fun, but also thoughtful and hit something that like sort of got at the bigger reason about why we cared about this thing that seems sort of frivolous. And my whole life is justifying like caring about frivolous things. So it felt good to like lock into it in like a long piece. And it was just like, it was, if I could go back, there was like very little about that that I would change, which I think is super rare. So that was probably the piece that felt like it did what I want most of my pieces to do.
Which is to, I don't know, you put it in your words?
Yeah, like make you laugh, make you feel like you're in the room having the experience that I'm having, which most of the time is just like a lot of fun, and makes you stop and think, oh, yeah, no, I get like the bigger picture about why this matters.
So can we talk a little bit about like the art of the celebrity profile?
Sure. I'm pretty artless, but like we can try.
I disagree with that. You've written about, at this point, like a great many famous people.
Yeah, I guess so.
You have.
Yeah, okay. If you say so.
And I'm interested in the process by which you do that. Like, I have all these assumptions about how celebrity profiles work. Like,
yeah,
they're heavily negotiated beforehand. You get a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
Has that been your experience? Are these things like heavily negotiated before you get in there? How does that work?
It sort of depends on the person, I guess. And I think that the cut's been, like, what I've been doing a lot for the cut, I think we're sort of lucky because people don't quite, they haven't previously thought of it as like when New York Magazine asks, because there is a little bit of a difference in like the public eye, I guess. And so like when we ask, they're like, oh, this website's asking, like this great website that we like a lot, but it's not going to require the same, like, let's negotiate. Can you ask this or can you not ask that? Again, it's just like you get to be a little bit freer, I think. So when I'm negotiating things specifically for the cut, it feels like I'm just asking for time. And then there's never much of a conversation about like, but you can't ask this and it has to be here. And those things that I think do bog down a lot of bigger profiles. But yeah, there's always a negotiation about how much access, which is like less and less all the time, which is not surprising.
Right.
People expect you to do stuff on like 45 minutes. And I'm like, this is bonkers. So I try.
Do you do that or does your editor do that?
I do that. I don't know why. Actually, I don't know how I've ended up doing it, but I do that. And sometimes for like the cut does digital covers, and sometimes for those, like other people will help wrangle, editors will help wrangle when it involves like a bigger shoot and things like that. But for the most part, like I make the first ask, and I always ask for like the stars and the moon. Mm-hmm. Like, can I get 3 days traveling across country with so and so? And they're like, how about 90 minutes in a restaurant? And I'm like, let's find the happy medium. So I always ask for us to do something together so I can observe them or like be in their environment, and then like a real sit down talk. And I kind of prefer like, can I just come with them to the thing they're doing that day? Like if they're just like going to run errands, or if they're just like going to the studio or taping a podcast, can I just come, as opposed to like, can we go skydiving together? Because I think for me, it's just, I prefer to observe people being themselves in their own environment as much as I can, being themselves.
Yeah,
with me watching them.
They're like, you just put a pretty big air quotes, and I feel like that's important. But do you feel like if they're doing whatever they were going to do that day anyway, even if there's going to be some like performance to it, it maybe will be like a little bit less because it was like already in the rhythms of their lives?
Yeah, exactly. And they always forget you're there. I've noticed that.
Do they?
Yeah, I think that, I guess like I'm actually far more unassuming than I thought I was, because like people seem to just like forget that I'm sitting in the room, which is great for me because then they're sort of like going about their day the way they would, or their experience the way they would.
Are there things that you do to make that happen?
Yeah, I definitely like sit in a corner and I like never speak. And I like don't ask. I'll jump in and ask questions if anything's clarified, or like, what are you doing? Or like, who was that person? Or, but like, I try not to like ask for like a glass of water. Like I'm like a small neglected child in the corner. That's how I kind of go into it. I just try and like blend into the chaos as much as I can, which is easier obviously when it's like backstage and there's like 50 people than it is like in a car with somebody. But yeah.
And when you're negotiating the access stuff, do you have a point at which you'll just walk away?
If I don't think I'll be able to get a good story out of it. And if it's like less than an hour, like I just like won't, there's no point, you know?
Cause you can't get anywhere interesting.
Right.
And most of those subjects, are they people that Stella or an editor is assigning you, or are they people that you're really eager to go talk to?
It's a mix of both, but it's generally editors are bringing me people that I would be excited about. And I rarely say no, because I do just get excited about most people for different reasons. Like, I think I didn't really know much about like a John David Washington But then when I Googled a little bit, I was like, oh, this is going to be interesting. And he's cute. Why not? but then I was really interested in doing like Tessa Thompson. Like, she's someone that I paid attention to a lot. And so I brought her to Stella and I was really excited. So sometimes you have to reverse engineer the excitement, but I can generally find. I've said no a few times.
Who have you said no to?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel sort of, okay, like someone offered me to do Liam Hemsworth recently and I was sort of like, he's beefy. Like, I don't have a ton else that but now when I think about it a little bit later, I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have said no because he just had that weird like Malibu fire thing and they like saved all their pets. And so like, there's at least like something interesting to like hop in there with. But no, I said no to that because I just didn't think I could really write that one well.
I really want to ask you like a follow-up question about that, but I don't know who that person is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, yeah, exactly. He's Miley Cyrus's fiance. He's Thor's younger brother who was in the Hunger Games.
Sure.
Yep. See, exactly. Yeah, that's the selling point.
You're pretty deep on that stuff though, right?
Yeah.
You're reading that stuff all the time.
Totally,
so you like, you knew that at least before there was like a wildfire that was threatening Malibu and Liam saved his cats.
Saved his pets, yeah.
That there wasn't a whole lot there for you. Do you feel like there's some, I've sort of gotten the sense sometimes when I've talked to like celebrity profilers that there's like a sport to it almost where it's like you can kind of find the interesting thing about anyone?
Yeah, totally.
Is that part of the game of it, is like, I'm going to figure out the interesting thing about this person?
Yeah, treating people like puzzles.
Yeah.
Totally, yeah. Like, I mean, because so much of celebrity journalism is like, here's the peg, right? You kind of have to pay attention to this person because they're being offered or they have a movie coming out, so they'll do the interviews. And so it does become fun, like, knowing that you kind of have to do it because sometimes, like, you know, like, some people at their jobs, they, like, have to fill in things in an Excel sheet. And, like, sometimes at my job, like, I have to do a story about X person because they have a movie coming out. And, like, that's my Excel sheet. Like, you just got to find the joy in it, right?
How do you do that?
I mean, like, every other celebrity profile, I, like, read everything. And then, much to my friends, like, they just hate me for this, I will sit down at dinners or, like, hang out and just, like, talk about the celebrity a lot until I find the thing that, like, interests them. So, like, Liam Hemsworth, I could sit there and talk to you about him for 15 minutes, and the thing that gets your eyes aglow is, like, oh, the Malibu fires? He was part of that? And then I know that's something to, like, ask about or, like, think about. And then also just sort of, like, well, what do I want to know about the person that has not been reported 18 times and like blogged about a million times? But mostly I do use my friends a lot because like if they're into it, then I think like the piece will be interesting.
Yeah. I got the same thing with these interviews. Like whatever the first thing that I tell someone about afterwards.
Yeah.
That's like, even if it's not like the most like hardcore piece of information, that's always the best part.
Exactly. You know? Like that's the part of the story that resonates.
And so the process is basically like talk to your friends. You look for the thing that's sort of like getting people to sit up in their chairs a little bit.
Yeah.
And then do you have a game plan? Like, say you have an hour.
Right.
Like, do you have like a game plan for how to get there in an hour? Or do you just kind of wing it?
I wing it much more than I should admit. I like to say I use my intuition. But it's also just like, I feel like every time I go into one of these, I've like forgotten the thing that like worked before. So I'm just like winging it. But no, like you go in with your questions in order. And like, at this point, you sort of can like, I can sort of sense when like, okay, we're probably hitting like the 40-minute mark, so I should probably like switch into a different mode or like get to that question that I like don't want to ask now.
Do you always have those questions?
I mean, doesn't everyone always have those questions?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think everyone has those questions. There's like that question that exists for every subject, so you have to like go for it. I've been told a couple times like, because I always try to do the thing that's like blame it on my editor, which is like such like a interviewing 101. I'm like, you know, my editor would be really mad if I didn't ask this question. Like, I'm sorry, we're conspirators here. I don't want to do it either. And I've had a couple subjects be like, but you don't actually have to ask me that. And I'm like, shit. Like, yes, I do, but like, shit. I know. Because now it feels weird that I'm going forth with it anyway. So my game plan, I do all my research. I write out my questions. I put them in order where I feel like the conversation will flow. And then I just like go in there and see how it feels.
Has there been a time recently where you walked out of one of those interviews and felt like you didn't get what you wanted?
Yeah. I can't say who it was because it's like not been published yet. But I just had one recently where like, I think I assumed we were going to connect way more than we did. So I walked in there like a little bit operating from a place of like, oh, we're going to be friends. So like I'm coming in hot. And she was different than I expected. And so my like gregarious, going to meet you at your level energy like didn't match hers at all. And so she closed up really fast and was answering questions in this sort of like, I don't feel quite comfortable. There's like something off about the way that we're interacting way. And by the end of it, like I probably only gotten through like half of my questions and the answers were sort of like, I need to ask you that question six more times to like get a good enough answer. Luckily I have another round with her, but like the first round was like not, I'm like, I have nothing.
What do you do when that happens? Like when you walk into a room like that and there's like a gap in the energy, how do you like modulate yourself?
That's generally when I like to shut up and like watch or just observe. But if you like don't have that, like if you're just like at lunch with somebody one-on-one, so you don't really have the time to like shut up and just watch them eat or whatever, I switch to more neutral questions and then just sort of let them talk longer than I probably would until they seem to have like loosened up some. And then I do make a lot of jokes, which like sometimes helps. But normally it's just sort of like giving them for as brief a time as you can, like giving them some of the power back so they feel like you're not coming in with an agenda.
Yeah.
And then like at a certain point, most people do calm down and sort of get back into it. And then you can find the conversation again. But it's such a power play, which I like, again, hate to admit because it feels like you're manipulating people. But like there are power shifts in the conversation. So.
Well, I'm interested in those dynamics.
Yeah.
Like you also were saying, like, I thought we were going to be friends.
Yeah.
And reading through your stuff, there's some of these pieces where it feels pretty clear to me that like you like them a lot.
Yeah, I can't hide that.
like that Cardi B profile, like you liked her.
Yeah, I had fun with her.
Yeah.
You know?
How does that, like, maybe this is just like talking something to death that's just like a normal human like interaction thing.
Yeah.
But like how does that, it feels to me like there's some tension there where it's like you're kind of like hanging out.
Right.
Potentially like getting along super well. But also there's this transactional thing going on, which is like you need to get your story and also she needs to get a profile in New York Magazine.
Right, right. I mean, the good thing is that, like, at this point in the, like, the celebrity profile complex, like, everybody's very aware of what part they have to play, right? Like, I interviewed Noah Centineo, and he's, like, nobody really knew who he was, and the story I did about him was probably one of his first, like, interviews. And already he knew, like, oh, I just gave you this scene for the article. Like, he, like, knew, like, what he had to do. And so, like, everybody sort of knows their roles, which is helpful for me because then I feel less like it's a transaction. If like everybody knows what the deal is, then you can't feel like it's too dishonest. And so you're just being the best, most truthful version of yourself, and that person is doing the same in this constructed situation because we're all aware of the construct at this point. I don't think anybody's fooled,
right,
you know, into thinking that I'm really their friend or that I think that they're really my friend. Like, we know that we're just gonna get along for 2 to 8 hours, and that's it.
You don't like stay friends with people afterwards.
I would love to, but it always feels, it does feel a little bit weird because you're right.
Have you like tried?
I don't want to admit that. Yeah, I mean, like I've seen subjects out in the world, and I'll go up and like say hello, and then sort of be like, well, now we're both in this social environment. Like, shouldn't we get to know one another really? And then like it doesn't work, and of course like. I maybe watched that movie Win a Date with Ted Hamilton too many times and thinking that like a celebrity might just like fall in love with like, would I have loved to stay friends with Michael B. Jordan, maybe married him one day? Sure. But like that didn't happen. Like he understood the transaction more than anybody. So I got fooled on that one.
It could still happen.
It could still happen. Maybe he'll listen to this podcast. I don't know.
All right. So like if you feel like there's this construct and everyone knows the deal, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is a transaction, but it's an okay transaction because everyone knows it's a transaction.
Right.
And like the market rates are set. Like the currency exchange,
yeah,
it's pretty stable. The like the celebrity profile is like tied to the dollar.
Right.
Everything's like, you know, God, a carton of milk costs. Like what a carton of milk costs.
Truly cynical, but yes. Okay.
Well, That's what you just said.
Yeah, maybe like not that cynically.
Okay, okay. We'll make it less cynical.
Okay, it's like a, like, I want to take it back. It's like a summer camp friendship, right? You know you're going to summer camp for 3 weeks and you're going to make friends that feel like your friggin' soulmate, like your best friend. Like you will die without that person. And then camp ends and you go home and you sort of think about them for a couple weeks longer, but then like you're back in your real life.
Yeah.
And like you could see that person again and be like, oh my God, my summer camp friend. I did like you a lot. Maybe we could pick this up. And like maybe it does and maybe it doesn't. But like for the most part, you understand that like summer camp is a finite amount of time and it's going to end and you're going to go back to reality.
Okay, that's more optimistic.
Yeah.
All right, fine. I will grant you that optimism.
Thank you. Except
in one way.
Oh, okay.
Which is like the difference with the celebrity profile is that everyone's gone to camp a bunch of times already.
Right.
And like knows the deal. So it feels to me from the outside like such a defined experience now.
Right.
For both the subject and the writer and the like final product that I wonder as someone who's like a couple years into doing this and doing it in a very like at a very high level in very prominent places. Like you've had many stories now that have like broken the internet and gone crazily viral and all this stuff. Do you feel some urge to try and like go to a different summer camp? Like, do you feel some urge to break that mold somehow? Or is it kind of impossible at this point?
I don't think it's impossible. I think like, yeah, there's like a list of things that these profiles have to do, right? You have to like explain who the person is and you have to like tell a story about the person and you have to do a thing with the person so you're not just two people in a room talking all the time. Like, I get that there's like a list of things where you're like, there is a celebrity profile template that's been followed forever. And like, I would love to figure out how to like really fuck up that template, but you totally can't. And I definitely feel like there was a run there of me writing things that felt really boring because I realized that like, I was just like hitting the template like hard, like paint by numbers sort of profile writing. And then I thought to myself, okay, I'm bored. I feel like every experience is sort of the same. Like X sits down and we do this, or like X enters a room and says this. So like, I think what got me to like the next level or just thinking about how to break it up was that the turn, I think, was a Tessa Thompson profile I did for the Cuts fashion issue last fall, where I just like sort of didn't have a template, right? Like I didn't ask for like the 90-minute sit down plus like a fun activity for the two of us to do together. It took like 2 days for us to even like figure out where to meet because I was like, we can do anything. Just like, let me know what you want to do. And we were like Instagram DMing, trying to figure out like, do you want to meet me here or maybe here or maybe here? And like the day I was supposed to interview her was like ticking by. And I was like, could you just tell me where to go? So like we met up at a cat cafe and like sort of like made decisions on the fly about where to go. And because it was such like a loosely formed, it felt like we didn't have the same agenda, right? Like that we weren't just like filling in the construct. And like at the end result did what a celebrity profile had to do, but there was some like spontaneity to it and some like looseness to it that I hadn't been able to do before. And so now like I feel more confident in sort of being like, let's just meet here and like let me sort of like see how where it can go. And you have to have publicists who are willing to let their people do that, right? Who are willing to like sort of let it go, which is not that easy to find.
Yeah.
Truly not. But it also has to do with like being on the ground with the person and sort of finessing that next step, which is something that Zach Baron from GQ taught me when I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do in these things. And he was like, most of the time, like a publicist will give me the in to like the first meeting and then I finesse everything else. And I was like, okay, that sounds difficult, but like, let's try it. And so now every time I have an interview with somebody, like, sure, we'll arrange that first meeting, but I'm like, let's do this. Or like, where are you going now? Can I go with you? Oh, your mom's upstairs. Can I meet your mom? And I feel like a creep, but like, you just, oh, there's one other tip I got from Jessica Pressler. That's you should always feel kind of uncomfortable in interviews, right? Because you have to keep asking for like the next level of access, the next level of access. So if you're not feeling uncomfortable about like how nosy you're being, then you're probably like not doing it right.
Do you feel like you should hear no?
You should at least get some like, I don't know. Because that's where the good stuff is, in the realm of like, I don't know if I should let you see this.
That's an interesting interviewing technique.
It's hard.
I gotta think about that.
Yeah. was like, I just feel like I'm really imposing myself, and you have to impose yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, like, it maybe like that line is not boring, but like safe.
Yeah, you don't want to be safe.
You know, and like if you can feel like something is going kind of wrong,
right.
or at least not as it was planned,
right?
It feels kind of exciting, you know? And I feel like a lot of these pieces you've been doing lately have gotten to that place. Like even that Tessa Thompson one, like it had this feel like you're like kind of like not sure exactly what was going to happen.
Right. Which is terrifying as like the interviewer, because like it really does sort of feel like it could go off the rails at any time. And you've like forgotten to ask the question about like her relationship with Janelle Monáe, and she's going to disappear into the night before you can. But also I think if you're just like open, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to say this. My editor at New York Mag will kill me. Sorry, Noreen. If you just put that energy out there, generally people like meet you where you are. So Wait. If you're open and you're like, we can do whatever, people will sort of like return that energy.
Unless you walk in and you're like, we're best friends. And they're like, I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, you got
to
pace yourself there. I know. Can't scare them with all the energy right away.
Wait, why would that bother Noreen? She's been on the show. I know Noreen a little bit.
Oh, because she hates when I talk about like energy in the universe. I'm like, I can't help it. I lived in Berkeley. Like I drank some of the Kool-Aid. So I do talk a lot about that.
We should talk a little bit about this last thing you did.
Yeah.
This last piece you wrote.
Yeah.
It's about Lena Dunham. And I should say that I've worked with Lena. I know her. Yeah. And I've worked on her podcast. So, you know, I'm not like an objective character in this thing. But that felt to me like a profile that did not, was not paint by numbers.
Oh, no. That one, that was like...
way outside the lines.
Yeah, that was like advanced art class for me. I was, even me, I was like, what the hell? What is going on?
What am I doing?
What? How is this still going? That was actually very, it was very stressful, but it was very exciting to be like, oh, I can, we're still, I can do this and I can come here and like, you're still going to text and like, we can just keep talking. Like, this like kept leveling up in this way I didn't expect. And that was truly exciting, but truly stressful.
With her in particular, like someone who's been written about so much.
Right.
What were your expectations?
So it was originally conceived as like a smaller profile. And then some like stuff happened to her that like delayed our second interview. So we just ended up having like a lot more time. And like, so I went to her house in LA twice over the course of 2 days. And then we were supposed to have another meeting in New York, but that got delayed because she had to go to surgery. And because of that, she was like just sort of chatting with me like in the interim. And then like we just like kept talking. And then we had another meeting and she was sort of like, oh, there's more to say. Can you meet again? And I was like, okay. And then so I said, can I come here to meet you? And it happened to be her like parents' house in Connecticut. And so like everything sort of just like got sort of like delayed in a way that gave it more space for us to build a bond that then meant that I could like keep asking for the next thing, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what was your, what do you think that experience would be like?
I thought it would be, I thought she would talk a lot because like she doesn't hold back. Right. And that's been well chronicled across all mediums. And so I expected to have like, honestly, I expected to sort of have like the experience that like David Mercazey has in his In Conversations, right? Where like he knows he's going to get like two long sit downs with the person and they're going to say some crazy shit. And then I would have to sort of like build a narrative around the crazy shit. And I sort of thought we would talk a lot. I would go through all the big controversies in the past years. And then I would sort of write about my like 2 hours with Lena Dunham, my 4 hours with Lena Dunham. And I was interested in that because I think, obviously, she'd been somebody that I'd been exposed to for so long and thought about for so long, whether or not I wanted to as like a consumer of culture. And also because she was a young woman in Brooklyn who wrote about and thought about and made shows about a life that I was sort of adjacent to. So I was interested in how that thing that felt like a couple degrees away could have gone in that direction. So I just wanted to talk to her about that. And about the pets and about being hated and about being hated and knowing about being hated and still continuing to be out there, putting yourself out there to be hated more. But I did not expect the level of like just the volume rather of what I got in within those little buckets. It was like overflowing, you know.
You kept saying like it was stressful.
Yeah.
In a way that you didn't say that about other things we've talked about. Why, like, what was stressful about it?
Just the feeling of, like, what is going on? I think that's really what stressed me out. It was like, what is going on? Also, sort of like, well, what am I going to do with all of this when I have to sit down and write? And that's like the thing, of course, it's like always in the back of your mind. Like, I'm doing all this. I'm experiencing all of this. We're like talking all the time, but I have 10 hours of tape and right. a notebook full of scene. And at some point I have to do that, like make that 7,000 words and do it in a way that like honors the experience and doesn't piss off everybody online and does everything it has to do, but at like a much higher level. So I was just stressed the whole time because the stakes felt a lot higher.
Well, that second one, like not pissing people off online, that's like kind of impossible. Right?
Yeah, it's truly impossible.
That can't really be a goal.
Listen, I'm like a little bit of a people pleaser. So like, it's not even piss people off online. I take that back. I think that there is, when you're working on something and you know that you're dealing with issues about race or gender or sexual assault, like, I don't want to ever bungle that, right? Because it's not even pissing people off. It's like, I don't want to like alienate people in a way that like I can't come back from as a writer. You know, like I feel like I should be sensitive to like writing about like Lena's experience with the sexual assault victim. I just got to be careful. Yeah. You have to be careful.
Yeah, it's funny, man. My sense reading that piece was like, in this moment where publicists are more engaged and access is like increasingly limited, it was the situation where like you had way too much to work with,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And it was interesting coming off of the profile I did right before of Michael B. Jordan, which was very much like much more in line with what you'd expect. Like, he's a big celebrity and he had just come off of like doing that huge Vanity Fair profile, and I was doing it for GQ's Man of the Year, and you know, he was sort of like, not a lot left to say, did you read the Vanity Fair thing? And I was like, well, I still have to do this, so let's go. And he gave me just what he wanted to give me, and he gave me a couple hours in a restaurant and that was it. And like, not, I didn't really get a follow-up. I didn't get to like text him. I tried to text his personal assistant a bunch to be like, is Michael available to chat? And that was one of those things where I was like, I'm going to try to use that 2 hours to finesse the next step. Like, I'll ask him to get a drink after, or like, we'll go like do XYZ. And he was very much like, no, me and my publicist have arranged that we're going to have this dinner and then I'm going to go live my life. And so that was when I was like, well, I don't really have a ton because it's the two of us sitting in a restaurant,
yeah,
you know, having like a good conversation, but like, the restaurant's empty and like it's like literally just all I have is this.
Well, that's the part of your job that I find so like intimidatingly hard. It's just like, all right, you're going to sit in a restaurant, empty restaurant,
right,
with a very famous movie star. It is the least natural like human interaction yeah, possible. And your job is to get him to like say something honest and human.
Yeah. It's not easy.
Fucking hard.
It's pretty hard. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's not, but like sometimes it's really hard. But, you know, you go on a lot of Tinder dates and you just like, it's the same skill set, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. Like, how do we get over the awkward hump to have a human conversation with a person you just like don't really know that you just like met online? Like, tell me how Tinder dating is any different from like doing a celebrity interview.
I don't know. You tell me.
It's not. Yeah.
It's the same.
I really think it's the same skill set. So.
Do you walk into Tinder dates sometimes with just like a lot of like, this is going to happen energy? And it just doesn't quite match up?
I have been accused of like interrogating people during dates. They're like, slow down with the questions. And I'm like, again, same skill set. So can't.
I'm an old married person, so I don't have the dating experience. But I have that experience a lot, except for me, it's at kids' birthday parties. Oh. Kids' birthday party is a terrible social situation because you actually have nothing in common with the adults
right.
in the room. And like, it's just boring to talk about like kids.
Right.
And I get in this mode at these birthday parties where I start like interviewing people because that's just how I know what to do. And people find it incredibly off-putting.
It doesn't work in social situations. It's
definitely not
sure.
at like 10 a.m. at like a gymboree. No one wants to talk about their fucking feelings.
They think you're the feds, man. That's
yeah.
Like, what?
Like, I've had multiple people just be like, I'm going to go get another donut. Like, please don't talk to me anymore.
Leave me alone.
This is not cool of you.
It's hard to turn off, right? It's like one mode of getting through social awkwardness.
I guess so. But I just feel like, yeah, Michael B. Jordan, like alone in a restaurant, that's like a very high stakes version of that.
Yes, exactly. And the exact opposite of like the Lena experience, which is weird to have in like the same month, like sort of like whiplash.
All right. So you decided that this is what you wanted to do. Willed your way into fashion magazines. You're good at the editorial part of assistant, bad at the assistant part of
assistant. Terrible at the assistant part of assistant.
Saw like the magazine industry crumbling around you.
Right.
Stuck with it because it was the only thing you wanted to do. And like it has worked. You now have the thing that very few people have, which is that you get to write, you get like paid decently to write big stories.
Yeah, please don't jinx me though. Like it never feels like it's gonna last.
Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, of course. Like I feel really lucky to do what I'm doing, but it's also like taste change. People are always like learning how to do this and like getting really good and leveling up. And so like I could be doing this year, but then like next year there's somebody else who's like even better and then I get like no assignments. You know, it's just like people could stop caring about celebrities and then I like don't have, that'll never happen. That'll never happen. But yeah, it does sort of feel like both sort of like, are you guys sure you want me to keep doing this? Because I will, but are you sure? Feeling and also just like knowing that like things move really, really fast now and like I could be like not the person to do this by like next year, you know?
It's interesting to me that you're where you feel stress is like people coming up underneath you and not like the industry imploding, like not crashing down from on top of you, you know?
Right.
Oh. Like New York Magazine's like out trying to sell and you guys are unionizing.
Right.
And this industry in which you find yourself, it's a different kind of perilous than it was when you had to go to grad school, but it's in a tricky moment.
Yeah. But maybe because I've always, like, as long as I've been doing this, it's been tricky and perilous and like about to implode. So it just feels like every day, like it's like the same every day. It doesn't feel any different.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm just like used to this level of anxiety. I don't know. I wouldn't know how to work in this industry any other way. But also like, I'm going to sound so Pollyanna again, but like, I have to believe that like, at the end of the day, people like want to read good, interesting pieces that are thoughtful and well-reported by people who have good voices. And maybe it won't be like a glossy magazine and maybe like people won't get like nice salaries or livable salaries. But like this will exist in some way or another. And like, so therefore, yes, I have to watch my back because like somebody else will crop up immediately, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if some 20-something starts asking you how you wrote that Lena story.
Not writing back to the emails.
Definitely do not pay back that kindness.
No, anyone's free to email me. I just I think we've spent the hour establishing that I have no real advice other than like don't fuck it up and be afraid all the time. That's the key to success. Don't fuck it up. Be a little bit anxious all the time.
Oh, that's like that's gonna be the last thing that anyone says on the podcast in 2018. And
cool.
I think it's perfect. Cool. Hey, Allison, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer, and I just want to say that Janelle had an incredible year editing the show. It is a hard job. She does it just sort of like effortlessly, but I know it's not effortlessly. It actually takes a great deal of effort. She just makes it seem effortless, and she makes us seem a lot more intelligent than we are. Thank you, Janelle, for everything in 2018. Thank you also, Tyler McCloskey, our intern, who pulled a lot in late nights working on the show. Thanks to both of you for everything in 2018. And thanks to our sponsors, who also made this show possible in 2018, MailChimp and Pit Writers. Their support makes it possible for us to do this show. And as you may have picked up on, this is our last one of 2018. We've got a rerun from the archives. We're going to put through the feed next week, but we will see you in January. We'll be back the first week of January with a new episode. And until then, there was one question that I really felt like I had to ask Allison. So even though I thought I had given her the last word, there was one more thing we had to talk about. I feel like I have to ask you
okay.
about BDE.
I can't escape it. What would you like to know?
I mostly want to know whether you feel like you could escape it.
No. I know. This is like, it's so funny. I wrote that blog post like right after I like killed myself to write this story about sex robots for the magazine. And BDE was like,
just say what it is first.
Oh,
for the one human being on Earth who doesn't know.
Stands for Big Dick Energy. And like, just go read the thing because I like don't want to have to explain what Big Dick Energy is.
You have to explain it.
Okay. It's because of Ariana Grande's now ex-boyfriend, Pete Davidson, who is like, people were trying to figure out why she was so attracted to him. And so this like thing, conversation started online about, wow, he looks like he has a big dick. And that's Big Dick Energy, like looking like you have a big dick. You got the confidence and like the swag that you just have a huge dick. And men and women can have it. But again, just like go read the thing, the explainer. So I had just like come off of this like sex robot story that I worked so hard on and like nobody read. And I was like, what the hell? And then BDE was like, I noticed it over the weekend, and I don't really blog anymore, but like I'll come out of retirement for things that really like make me laugh. And so I blogged about it on like a random Tuesday, and then I like can't, and everybody read it. And it's like, did anybody read the magazine feature I slaved over? Nope, just BDE. That's fine. Just why do I
just
try?
That like couple hundred word blog post.
Right. Again, why do I bother? So yeah, I will never escape BDE. I guess it's not a bad thing. I've come to terms with it. I'm like back to liking it, being part of my like index of articles now.
Do you feel like will you continue on the BDE beat? Will you return to BDE occasionally?
I think that like a little bit of BDE exists in a lot of my pieces. You can always find the moment where I'm assessing someone's BDE. So it lives on in various ways.
Okay, that's actually going to be the last words of someone here in 2018.
That's better than like anxiety and fear. So,
Allison, thanks.
Thank you.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.